told Jamie. And she's flying the Union flag. She's a naval cutter, said Captain Roberts, who had appeared on my other side and was peering grimly through his telescope. Shit. Jamie's hand went to his dirk, unconsciously checking, and he looked over the captain's shoulder, eyes narrowed against the wind. I could see the sail now coming up rapidly to starboard.
Can we outrun her, Cap'n?
The first mate had joined the crowd at the rail, watching the oncoming ship. She did have guns, 6 that I could see, and there were men behind them. The captain pondered, absently clicking his glass open and shut, then glanced up into the rigging, presumably estimating the chances of our putting on enough sail to outdistance the pursuer. The mainmast was cracked. He'd been intending to replace it in New Haven.
No, he said gloomily. The main'll be away if there's any strain put on her.
He shut the telescope with a decisive click and stowed it away in his pocket.
Have to brass it out best we can.
I wondered just how much of Captain Roberts' cargo was contraband. His taciturn face didn't give anything away, but there was a distinct air of uneasiness among the hands, which grew noticeably as the cutter drew alongside, hailing. Roberts gave the terse order to heave to, and the sails loosened, the ship slowing. I could see seamen at the guns and rail of the cutter, glancing sideways at Jamie. I saw that he was counting them, and glanced back.
I make it 16, Ian said, low-voiced. Underman, goddammit, said the captain.
He looked at Ian, estimating his size, and shook his head.
They'll likely mean to press what they can out of us. Sorry, lad.
The rather formless alarm I'd felt at the cutter's approach sharpened abruptly at this, and sharpened still further as I saw Roberts glance appraisingly at Jamie.
You don't think they...
I began.
Shame you shaved this morning, Mr. Fraser, Roberts observed to Jamie, ignoring me. Takes 20 years off your age. You look a damn sight healthier than men half your age. I'm obliged to you for the compliment, sir, Jamie replied dryly, one eye on the railing where the cocked hat of the cutter's captain had suddenly poked up like an ill-omened mushroom.
He unbuckled his belt, slid the dirk's scabbard free, and handed it to me.
Keep that for me, Sassenach, he said under his breath, buckling his belt again.
The cutter's captain, a squat middle-aged man with a sullen brow and a pair of much-mended breeches, took a quick, piercing look around the deck when he came aboard, nodded to himself as though his worst suspicions had been confirmed, then shouted back over his shoulder for 6 men to follow.
"Search the hold," he said to his minions. "You know what to look for." "What sort of way is this to carry on?" Captain Roberts demanded angrily. "You've no right to search my ship. What do you lot think you are, a raft of bloody pirates?" "Do I look like a pirate?"
The cutter's captain looked more pleased than insulted by the idea.
"Well, you can't be a naval captain, I'm sure," Roberts said coldly. "A nice gentleman-like set of individuals I've always found His Majesty's Navy. Not the sort to board a respectable merchant without leave. Let alone without proper introduction."
The cutter's captain appeared to find this funny. He took off his hat and bowed. To me.
"Allow me, mum," he said. "Captain Worth Stebbins, your most humble."
He straightened up, clapping on his hat, and nodded to his lieutenant.
"Go through the holds like a dose of salts, and you,"
he tapped Roberts on the chest with a forefinger, "get all your men on deck, front and centre, Cully. All of them, mind. If I have to drag them up here, I won't be best pleased, I warn you." Tremendous bangings and rumblings from below ensued, with seamen popping up periodically to relay news of their findings to Captain Stebbings, who lounged by the rail, watching as the men of the Teal were rounded up and herded together on deck, Ian and Jamie among them.
"You know, Captain Roberts was game, I'd give him that. Mr. Fraser and his nephew aren't crew. They're paying passengers. You've no call to molest free men about their lawful business, and no right to press my crew either."
"They're British subjects," Stebbings informed him briefly,
I've every right. Or do you all claim to be Americans?
He leered briefly at that. If the ship could be considered a rebel vessel, he could simply take the whole thing as a prize, crew and all. A mutter at this ran through the men on deck, and I saw more than one of the hands' eyes dart to the belaying pins along the rail. Stebbings saw it too, and called over the rail for four more men to be brought aboard, with arms. 16 minus 6 minus 4 is 6, I thought, and edged a little closer to the rail to peer into the cutter rocking in the swell a little way below, and tethered by a line to the teal. If the 16 doesn't include Captain Stebbings, if it does... One man was at the helm, this being not a wheel, but a sort of stick-like arrangement poking up through the deck. Two more were manning a gun, a long brass thing on the bow, pointed at the teal's side. Where were the others? Two on deck? The others, perhaps, below. Captain Roberts was still haranguing Stebbings behind me, but the cutter's crew were bumping barrels and bundles over the deck, calling for a rope to lower away to the cutter. I looked back to find Stebbings walking along the row of crewmen, indicating his choices to four burly men who followed him. These jerked his choices out of line and set about tying them together, a line running from ankle to ankle. Three men had already been chosen, John Smith among them looking white-faced and tense. My heart jumped at sight of him, then nearly stopped altogether as Stebbings came to Ian, who looked down at him impassively.
"Likely, likely," Stebbings said with approval. "A cross-grained son of a bitch by the looks of you, but we'll soon knock sense into you. Take him."
I saw the muscles swell in Ian's forearms as his fists clenched. But the press gang was armed, two with pistols drawn, and he stepped forward, though with an evil look that would have given a wiser man pause. I had already observed that Captain Stebbings was not a wise man. Stebbings took two more, then paused at Jamie, looking him up and down. Jamie's face was carefully blank, and slightly green. The wind was still up, and with no forward sway on the ship, she was rising and falling heavily, with a lurch that would have disconcerted a much better sailor than he was.
"Nice big 'un, sir,"
said one of the press gang, with approval.
"Trifle elderly," Stebbings said dubiously, "and I don't much like the look on his face."
"I dinna care much for the look of yours," Jamie said pleasantly.
He straightened, squaring his shoulders, and looked down his long, straight nose at Stebbings.
"If I didna ken you for an arrant coward by your actions, sir, I should know you for a fig-licker and a fop-doodle by your foolish wee face."
Stebbings' maligned face went blank with astonishment, then darkened with rage. One or two of the press gang grinned behind his back, though hastily erasing these expressions as he whirled round.
"Take him,"
he growled to the press gang, shouldering his way toward the booty he collected by the rail,
"and see that you drop him a few times on the way."
I was frozen in shock. Clearly Jamie couldn't let them press Ian and take him away, but surely he couldn't mean to abandon me in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean either. Not even with his dirk thrust into the pocket tied beneath my skirt, and my own knife in its sheath around my thigh. Captain Roberts had watched this little performance open-mouthed, though whether with respect or astonishment I couldn't tell. He was a short man, rather tubby, and clearly not constructed for physical confrontation, but he set his jaw and stamped up to Stebbings, seizing him by the sleeve. The crew ushered their captives over the rail. There wasn't time to think of anything better. I seized the rail and more or less rolled over it, skirts flying. I hung by my hands for a terrifying instant, feeling my fingers slide across the wet wood, groping with my toes for the rope ladder the cutter's crew had thrown over the rail. A roll of the ship threw me hard against the side. I lost my grip, plunged several feet, and caught the ladder just above the cutter's deck. The rope had burned through my right hand, and it felt as though I'd lost all the skin off my palm, but there was no time to trouble about that now. Any minute, one of the cutter's crew would see me, and... Timing my jump to the next heave of the cutter's deck, I let go and landed like a bag of rocks. A sharp pain shot up the inside of my right knee, but I staggered to my feet, lurching to and fro with the roll of the deck, and lunged toward the companionway.
"Beer, you, what are you doing?"
One of the gunners had seen me and was gaping at me, clearly unable to decide whether to come down and deal with me or stay with his gun. His partner looked over his shoulder at me and bellowed at the first man to stay put. It wasn't but monkey business of some sort, he said.
Stay put, goddamn your eyes.
I ignored them, my heart pounding so hard I could scarcely breathe.
What now?
What next? Jamie and Ian had disappeared.
Jamie,
I shouted as loudly as I could. I'm here. And then ran toward the line that held the cutter to the teal, jerking up my skirt as I ran. I did this only because my skirts had twisted in my undignified descent and I couldn't find the slit to reach through in order to get at the knife in its sheath on my thigh. But the action itself seemed to disconcert the helmsman who had turned at my shout. He gawped like a goldfish, but had sufficient presence of mind as to keep his hand on the tiller. I got my own hands on the line and dug my knife into the knot, using it to pry the tight coils loose. Roberts and his crew, bless them, were making a terrible racket on the teal above, quite drowning out the shouts of the helm and the gunners. One of these, with a desperate glance toward the deck of the teal above, finally made up his mind and came toward me, jumping down from the bow. What wouldn't I give for a pistol just now, I thought grimly. But a knife was what I had, and I jerked it out of the half-loosened knot and drove it into the man's chest as hard as I could. His eyes went round, and I felt the knife strike bone and twist in my hand, skipping through the flesh. He shrieked and fell backward, landing on deck in a thump and nearly, but not quite, taking my knife with him.
Sorry, I gasped,
and panting, resumed work on the knot, the fractious rope now smeared with blood. There were noises coming from the companionway now. Jamie and Ian might not be armed, but my guess was that that wouldn't matter a lot in close quarters. The rope slid reluctantly free. I jerked the last coil loose and it fell, slapping against the teal's side. At once, the current began carrying the boats apart, the small cutter sliding past the big sloop. We weren't moving quickly at all, but the optical illusion of speed made me stagger, gripping at the rail for balance. The wounded gunner had got onto his feet and was advancing on me, staggering but furious. He was bleeding, but not heavily, and was by no means disabled. I stepped quickly sideways, and glancing at the companionway, was relieved beyond measure to see Jamie coming out of it. He reached me in three strides.
Quick, my duck.
I stared at him blankly for a moment, then remembered, and with no more than minimum fumbling, managed to get at my pocket. I jerked at the hilt of the dirk, but it was tangled in the fabric. Jamie seized it, ripped it free, tearing both the pocket and the waistband of my skirt in the process, whirled, and charged back into the bowels of the ship, leaving me facing a wounded gunner, an unwounded gunner, now making his way cautiously down from his station, and the helmsman, who was yelling hysterically for someone to do something to some sort of sail. I swallowed and took a good hold on the knife. Stand back, I said, in as loud and commanding a voice as I could manage. Given my shortness of breath, the wind and the prevailing noise, I doubt they heard me. On the other hand, I doubted that it would have made a difference if they had. I yanked my sagging skirt up with one hand, crouched and lifted the knife in a determined manner, meant to indicate that I knew what to do with it. I did. Waves of heat were going over my skin, and I felt perspiration prickle my scalp, drying at once in the cold wind. The panic had gone, though. My mind felt very clear and very remote. "You aren't going to touch me," was the only thing in my mind. The man I had wounded was cautious, hanging back. The other gunner saw nothing but a woman and didn't bother to arm himself, simply reaching for me with angry contempt. I saw the knife move upward fast and arc as though moving by itself, the shimmer of it dulled with blood as I slashed him across the forehead. Blood poured down over his face, blinding him, and he gave a strangled yell of hurt and astonishment, and backed away, both hands pressed to his face. I hesitated for a moment, not quite sure what to do next, the blood still pounding through my temples. The ship was drifting, rising and falling on the waves. I felt the gold-laden hem of my skirt scrape across the boards and jerk the torn waistband up again, feeling irritated. Then I saw a belaying pin stuck into its hole in the railing, a line wrapped around it. I walked over and, poking the knife down the bodkin of my stays for lack of any better place to put it, took hold of the pin with both hands and jerked it free. Holding it like a short baseball bat, I shifted back on one heel and brought it down with as much force as I could on the head of the man whose face I'd slashed. The wooden pin bounced off his skull with a hollow ringing noise, and he staggered away, caroming off the mast. The helmsman at this point had had enough. Leaving his helm to mind itself, he scrambled up out of his station and made for me like an angry monkey, all reaching limbs and bared teeth. I tried to hit him with the pin, but I'd lost my grip when I struck the gunner, and it slipped out of my hand, rolling away down the heaving deck as the helmsman flung himself on me. He was small and thin, but his weight bore me back, and we lurched together toward the rail. My back struck it, and all my breath rushed out in a whoosh, the impact a solid bar of shock across my kidneys. This transformed within seconds to live agony, and I writhed under him, sliding downward. He came with me, grappling for my throat with a single-minded purpose. I flailed at him, my arms, my hands striking windmill-like at his head, the bones of his skull bruising me. The wind was roaring in my ears. I heard nothing but breathless cursing, harsh gasps that might be mine or his. And then he knocked my hands away and grabbed me by the neck, one-handed, his thumb digging hard up under my jaw. It hurt, and I tried to knee him, but my legs were swaddled in my skirt and pinned beneath his weight. My vision went dark, with little bursts of gold light going off in the blackness, tiny fireworks heralding my death. Someone was making little mewling noises, and I realized dimly that it must be me. The grip on my neck tightened, and the flashing lights faded into black. I woke with a confused sense of being simultaneously terrified and rocked in a cradle. My throat hurt, and when I tried to swallow, the resultant pain made me choke.
"You're all right, Sassenach."
Jamie's soft voice came out of the surrounding gloom. Where was I? And his hand squeezed my forearm, reassuring.
"I'll take your word for it,"
I croaked, the effort making my eyes water. I coughed. It hurt, but seemed to help a little.
What?
Have a bit of water, Anian.
A big hand cradled my head, lifting it a bit, and the mouth of a canteen pressed against my lip. Swallowing the water hurt too, but I didn't care. My lips and throat were parched and tasted of salt. My eyes were beginning to accustom themselves to the darkness. I could see Jamie's form hunched under a low ceiling, and the shape of rafters, no, timbers, overhead. A strong smell of tar and bilges. Ship. Of course we were in a ship. But which ship?
Where?
I whispered, waving a hand.
I haven't got the slightest idea,
he said, sounding rather irritable.
The Teal's people are managing the sails, I hope. And Ian's holding a pistol on one of the naval folk to make him steer. But for all I ken, the man's taking us straight out to sea.
I meant, what ship?
Though his remarks had made that clear enough, we must be on the naval cutter.
They said the name of it is the Pit.
How very appropriate.
I looked glassily around the murky surroundings, and my sense of reality suffered another jolt as I saw a huge mottled bundle of some kind, apparently hanging in the dim air a few feet beyond Jamie. I sat up abruptly, or tried to, only at this point realizing that I was in a hammock. Jamie seized me by the waist with a cry of alarm, in time to save me pitching out on my head, and as I steadied, clutching him, I realized that the thing I had taken as an enormous cocoon was in fact a man, lying in another hammock, suspended from the rafters, but trussed up in it like a spider's dinner, and gagged, his face pressed against the mesh, glaring at me.
"Jesus H. Roosevelt," I croaked,
and lay back, breathing heavily.
"Do you want to rest a bit, Sassenach, or shall I set ye on your feet?" Jamie asked, clearly edgy. "I didn't want to leave Ian on his own too long."
"No," I said, struggling upright once more. "Help me out, please."
The room, cabin, whatever it was, spun round me as well as heaving up and down, and I was obliged to cling to Jamie with my eyes closed for a moment until my internal gyroscope took hold. "Captain Roberts?" I asked. "The teal?"
"God knows," Jamie said tersely. "We ran for it as quick as I could set the men to sailing this thing. For all I ken, they're on our tail, but I couldn't see anything when I looked astern."
I was beginning to feel steadier, though the blood still throbbed painfully in my throat and temples with each heartbeat, and I could feel the tender patches of bruising on my elbows and shoulders, and a vivid band across my back where I'd fallen against the rail.
"We've shut most of the crew up in the hold," Jamie said, with a nod at the man in the hammock. "Save this fellow. I didna ken whether you might want to look at him first. In the medical way, I mean," he added, seeing my momentary incomprehension. "Though I dinna think he's hurt badly."
I approached the fellow in the hammock and saw that it was the helmsman who had tried to throttle me. There was a large lump visible on his forehead, and he had the beginnings of a monstrous black eye. But from what I could see, leaning close in the dim light, his pupils were the same size, and allowing for the rag stuffed into his mouth, his breath was coming regularly. Probably not badly hurt, then. I stood for a moment staring at him. It was difficult to tell. The only light below decks came from a prism embedded in the deck above. But I thought that perhaps what I had taken for a glare was really just a look of desperation.
"Do you need to have a pee?" I inquired politely.
The man and Jamie made nearly identical noises, though in the first case it was a groan of need, and in Jamie's, of exasperation.
"For God's sake," he said, grabbing my arm as I started to reach for the man. "I'll deal with him. Go upstairs."
It was apparent from his much-tried tone that he had just about reached the last straw stage, and there was no point in arguing with him. I left, making my way gingerly up the companionway ladder to the accompaniment of a lot of Gaelic muttering that I didn't try to translate. The belting wind above was enough to make me sway alarmingly as it caught my skirts, but I seized a line and held on, letting the fresh air clear my head before I felt steady enough to go aft. There I found Ian, as advertised, sitting on a barrel, a loaded pistol held negligently atop one knee, evidently engaged in amiable discourse with the sailor at the helm.
"Auntie Claire, all right, are you?"
he asked, jumping up and gesturing me towards his barrel.
"Fine,"
I said, taking it. I didn't think I'd torn anything in my knee, but it felt a little wobbly.
"Claire Fraser,"
I said, nodding politely to the gentleman at the helm, who was black and bore facial tattoos of an elaborate sort, though from the neck down he was dressed in ordinary sailor's slops.
"Guinea Dick,"
he said, with a broad grin that displayed, no doubt about it, filed teeth.
"Your servant, mum."
I regarded him open-mouthed for a moment, but then regained some semblance of self-possession and smiled at him. "I see His Majesty takes his seamen where he can get them," I murmured to Ian.
"He does, for a fact. Mr. Dick here was pressed out of a Guinea pirate who took him from a slave ship, who in turn took him from a barracoon on the Guinea coast. I'm no so sure whether he thinks His Majesty's accommodations are an improvement, but he says he's got nae particular reservation about going along of us."
"Is your trust upon him?"
I asked in halting Gaelic. Ian gave me a mildly scandalized look.
"Of course not," he replied in the same language, "and you will oblige me by not going too close to him, wife of my mother's brother. He says to me that he does not eat human flesh, but this is no surety that he is safe.
Right, I said, returning to English. What happened to... Before I could complete my question, a loud thump on deck made me turn to see John Smith, he of the 5 gold earrings, who had dropped out of the rigging. He too smiled when he saw me, though his face was strained.
Well enough so far, he said to Ian, and touched his forelock to me. You all right, ma'am?
Yes. I looked aft, but saw nothing save tumbling waves, the same in all the other directions as well. Do you happen to know where we are going, Mr. Smith? He looked a trifle surprised at that.
Why no, ma'am. The captain hasn't said.
The cap...
That would be Uncle Jimmy, Ian said, sounding amused. Puking his guts out below, is he?
Not when last seen. I began to have an uneasy feeling at the base of my spine. Do you mean to tell me that no one aboard this ship has any idea where, or even which way we're heading? An eloquent silence greeted this question. I coughed. The, gunner. Not the one with the slashed forehead. The other one. Where is he, do you know? Ian turned and looked at the water.
Oh, I said.
There was a large splotch of blood on the deck where the man had fallen when I stabbed him.
Oh, I said again. Oh, which reminds me, Auntie. I found this lying on the deck.
Ian took my knife from his belt and handed it to me. It had been cleaned, I saw. Thank you. I slipped it back through the slit of my petticoats and found the scabbard still fastened round my thigh, though someone had removed my torn skirt and pocket. With thought for the gold in the hem, I hoped it was Jamie. I felt rather peculiar, as though my bones were filled with air. I coughed and swallowed again, massaging my bruised throat, then returned to my earlier point. So, no one knows which way we're heading. John Smith smiled a little.
Well, we're not a-heading out to sea, ma'am, if that's what you were fearing.
I was, actually. How do you know? All 3 of them smiled at that.
Him son over dear,
Mr. Dick said, shrugging a shoulder at the object in question. He nodded in the same direction.
So him land over dear too. Ah, well, that was comforting, to be sure.
And in fact, since him son was over there, that is, sinking rapidly in the west, that meant we were, in fact, headed north. Jamie joined the party at this point, looking pale.
Captain Fraser,
Smith said respectfully.
Mr. Smith. Orders, Captain.
Jamie stared at him bleakly.
I'll be pleased if we don't sink. Can you manage that?
Mr. Smith didn't bother hiding his grin.
If we don't need another ship or whale, sir, I think we'll stay afloat. Good. Kindly don't.
Jamie wiped the back of his hand across his mouth and straightened up.
Is there a port we might reach within the next day or so? The helmsman says there's food and water enough for 3 days, but the less of it we need, the happier I'll be.
Smith turned to squint toward the invisible land, the setting sun glinting off his earrings.
Well, we're past Norfolk, he said, thoughtful. The next big regular port would be New York.
Jamie gave him a jaundiced look.
Is the British Navy not anchored in New York?
Mr. Smith coughed.
I believe they were, last I heard. Of course, they might have moved.
I was more in mind of a small port, Jamie said.
Very small.
Where the arrival of a Royal Naval cutter will make the maximum impression on the citizenry? I inquired. I sympathised with his strong desire to set foot on land as soon as possible, but the question was, what then? The enormity of our position was only now beginning to dawn on me. We had gone in the space of an hour from passengers on the way to Scotland to fugitives on the way to God knew where. Jamie closed his eyes and drew a long, deep breath. There was a heavy swell, and he was looking green again, I saw. And with a pang of uneasiness, realized that I had lost my acupuncture needles left behind in my hasty exodus from the Teal. What about Rhode Island or New Haven, Connecticut? I asked. New Haven is where the Teal was going anyway, and I think we're much less likely to run into Loyalists or British troops in either of those ports. Jamie nodded, eyes still closed, grimacing at the movement.
Aye, maybe. Not Rhode Island, Smith objected. The British sailed into Newport in December, and the American Navy, what there is of it, is blockaded inside Providence. They might not fire on us if we come a-sailing into Newport with the British colours flying.
He gestured at the mast where the Union Jack still fluttered.
But the reception, once ashore, might be warmer than we might find comfortable.
Jamie had cracked one eye open and was regarding Smith consideringly.
I take it you've no Loyalist leanings yourself, Mr. Smith. For if you had, nothing simpler than to tell me to land at Newport. I'd not have known any better. No, sir.
Smith tugged at one of his earrings.
Mind, I'm not a separatist, neither. But I have got a marked disinclination to be sunk again. Reckon I just about used up my luck in that direction.
Jamie nodded, looking ill.
New Haven, then, he said.
And I felt a small thump of uneasy excitement. Might I meet with Hannah Arnold after all? Or, and there was an uneasier notion still, Colonel Arnold himself?
I supposed he must visit his family once in a while.
A certain amount of technical discussion, involving a lot of shouting to and fro between deck and rigging, ensued regarding navigation. Jamie knew how to use both a sextant and an astrolabe. The former was actually available, but had no idea how to apply the results to the sailing of a ship. The impressed hands from the Teal were more or less agreeable to sailing the ship wherever we cared to take her, as their only immediate alternative was being arrested, tried, and executed for involuntary piracy. But while all were good, able seamen, none of them possessed anything in the way of navigational skills. This left us with the alternative strategies of interviewing the captive seamen in the hold, discovering whether any of them could sail the ship, and if so, offering such inducements in the way of violence or gold as might compel him to do so, or sailing within sight of land and hugging the coast, which was slower, much more dangerous in terms of encountering either sandbanks or British men of war, and uncertain insofar as none of the Teal hands presently with us had ever seen the port of New Haven before. Having nothing useful to contribute to this discussion, I went to stand by the rail, watching the sun come down the sky, and wondering how likely we were to run aground in the dark, without the sun to steer by. The thought was cold, but the wind was colder. I had been wearing only a light jacket when I made my abrupt exit from the Teal, and without my woolen overskirt, the sea wind was cutting through my clothes like a knife. That unfortunate imagery reminded me of the dead gunner, and steeling myself, I glanced over my shoulder toward the dark bloodstain on deck. As I did so, my eye caught the flicker of a movement from the helm, and I opened my mouth to call out. I hadn't managed a sound, but Jamie happened to be looking in my direction, and whatever was showing on my face was enough. He turned and threw himself without hesitation at Guinea Dick, who had produced a knife from somewhere about his person, and was preparing to plunge it into Ian's negligently turned back. Ian whirled round at the noise, saw what was up, and thrusting the pistol into Mr. Smith's surprised hands, flung himself on the thrashing ball of humanity, rolling round under the swinging helm. Fallen off her steerage, the ship slowed, her sails slackening, and she began to roll alarmingly. I took two steps across the slanting deck and plucked the pistol neatly out of Mr. Smith's hand. He looked at me, blinking in bewilderment. "It's not that I don't trust you," I said apologetically. "It's just that I can't take the chance, all things considered." Calmly, all things considered, I checked the pistol's priming. It was primed and cocked,
I wonder it hadn't gone off by itself with all this rough handling, and aimed it at the centre of the melee, waiting to see who might emerge from it. Mr. Smith looked back and forth from me to the fight, and then backed slowly away, hands delicately raised.
"I'll just be up top," he said, "if wanted."
The outcome had been a foregone conclusion, but Mr. Dick had acquitted himself nobly as a British seaman. Ian rose slowly, swearing, and pressing his forearm against his shirt, where a jagged wound left red blotches.
"The treacherous bugger bit me," he said, furious. "God-damned cannibal heathen."
He kicked his erstwhile foe, who grunted at the impact, but remained inert, and then seized the swinging helm with an angry oath. He moved this slowly to and fro, seeking direction, and the ship steadied, her head turning into the wind as her sails filled again. Jamie rolled off the supine body of Mr. Dick and sat on the deck beside him, head hanging, panting for breath. I lowered the gun and uncocked it. "All right?" I asked him, for form's sake. I felt very calm, in a remote, strange sort of way.
"Trying to recall how many lives I've got left," he said, between gasps.
"Four, I think. Or five. Surely you don't consider this a near miss, do you?"
I glanced at Mr. Dick, whose face was considerably the worse for wear. Jamie himself had a large red patch down the side of his face that would undoubtedly be black and blue within hours, and was holding his middle, but seemed otherwise undamaged.
"Does nearly dying of seasickness count?"
"No." With a wary eye on the fallen helmsman, I squatted beside Jamie and peered at him. The red light of the sinking sun bathed the deck, making it impossible to judge his colour, even had the colour of his skin made this easy. Jamie held out a hand, and I gave him the pistol which he tucked into his belt, where, I saw, he had restored his dirk and its scabbard.
"Did you not have time to draw that?" I asked, nodding at it.
"Didn't I want to kill him? He's no dead, is he?"
With a noticeable effort, he rolled onto hands and knees and breathed for a moment before thrusting himself to his feet.
"No, he'll come round in a minute or two."
I looked toward Ian, whose face was averted, but whose body language was eloquent. His stiff shoulders, suffused back of neck, and bulging forearms conveyed fury and shame, which were understandable. But there was a droop to his spine that spoke of desolation. I wondered at that last, until a thought occurred to me, and that odd sense of calm vanished abruptly in a burst of horror as I realized what must have made him drop his guard.
"Rollo," I whispered, clutching Jamie's arm.
He looked up, startled, saw Ian, and exchanged appalled glances with me.
"Oh, God," he said softly.
The acupuncture needles were not the only things of value left behind aboard the Teal. Rollo had been Ian's closest companion for years, the immense byproduct of a casual encounter between an Irish wolfhound and a wolf. He terrified the hands on the Teal to such an extent that Ian had shut him in the cabin. Otherwise, chances were that he would have taken the throat out of Captain Stebbings when the sailors seized Ian. What would he do when he realized that Ian was gone? And what would Captain Stebbings, his men, or the crew of the Teal do to him in response?
"Jesus, they'll shoot the dog and drop him overboard," Jamie said,
voicing my thought, and crossed himself. I thought of the hammerhead again, and a violent shudder ran through me. Jamie squeezed my hand tightly.
"Oh, God," he said again, very quietly.
He stood thinking for a moment, then shook himself, rather like Rollo shaking water from his fur, and let go my hand.
"I'll have to speak to the crew, and we must feed them, and the sealers in the hold. Will you go below Sassenach and see what you can do with the galley? I'll just have a word with Ian first."
I saw his throat move as he glanced at Ian,
standing stiff as a wooden Indian at the helm, the dying light harsh on his tearless face. I nodded, and made my way unsteadily to the black gaping hole of the companionway, and the descent into darkness. The galley was no more than a 4x4 space below decks at the end of the mess, with a sort of low brick altar containing the fire, several cupboards on the bulkhead, and a hanging rack of coppers, pot lifters, rags, and other bits of kitchen impedimenta. No problem in spotting it. There was still a sullen red glow from the galley fire where, thank God, a few embers still lived. There was a sandbox, a coal box, and a basket of kindling tidied under the tiny countertop, and I set at once to coaxing the fire back into life. A cauldron hung over the fire. Some of the contents had slopped over the side as a result of the ship's rolling, partially extinguishing the fire and leaving gummy streaks down the side of the cauldron. Luck again, I thought. Had the slop not put the fire mostly out, the contents of the pot would long since have boiled dry and burned, leaving me with a job of starting some kind of supper from scratch. Perhaps literally from scratch. There were several stacked cages of chickens near the galley. They'd been dozing in the warm darkness, but roused at my movement, fluttering, muttering, and jerking their silly heads to and fro in agitated inquiry, beady eyes blinking redly at me through the wooden lattice. I wondered whether there might be other livestock aboard, but if there was, it wasn't living in the galley, thank goodness. I stirred the pot, which seemed to contain a glutinous sort of stew, and then began to look for bread. There would be some sort of farinaceous substance, I knew. Sailors lived off either hardtack, the very aptly named unleavened ship's biscuit, or softtack, this being any kind of leavened bread, though the term soft was often relative. Still, they would have bread. Where? I found it at last. Hard, round, brown loaves in a netting bag hung from a hook in a dark corner. To keep it from rats, I supposed, and glanced narrowly around the floor just in case. There should be flour as well, I thought. Oh, of course, it would be in the hold, along with the other ship's stores, and the disgruntled remnants of the original crew. Well, we'd worry about them later. There was enough here to feed everyone aboard supper. I'd worry about breakfast later, too. The exertion of building up the fire and searching the galley and mess warmed me and distracted me from my bruises. The sense of chilled disbelief that had attended me ever since I went over the Teal's rail began to dissipate. This wasn't entirely a good thing. As I began to emerge from my state of stunned shock, I also began to apprehend the true dimensions of the current situation. We were no longer headed for Scotland and the dangers of the Atlantic, but were underway to an unknown destination in an unfamiliar craft with an inexperienced, panic-stricken crew. And we had, in fact, just committed piracy on the high seas, as well as whatever crimes were involved in resisting impressment and assaulting His Majesty's Navy. And murder. I swallowed, my throat still tender, and my skin prickled despite the warmth of the fire. The jar of the knife hitting bone still reverberated in the bones of my own hand and forearm. How could I have killed him? I knew I hadn't penetrated his chest cavity, couldn't possibly have struck the large vessels of the neck. Shock, of course, but could shock alone? I couldn't think about the dead gunner just now, and pushed the thought of him firmly away. Later, I told myself, I would come to terms with it. It had been self-defense after all, and I would pray for his soul, but later. Not now. Not that the other things presenting themselves to me as I worked were much more appealing. Ian and Rollo. No, I couldn't think about that either. I scraped the bottom of the pot determinedly with a big wooden spoon. The stew was a little scorched at the bottom, but still edible. There were bones in it, and it was thick and gummy, with lumps. Gagging slightly, I filled a smaller pot from a water butt and hung it to boil.
Navigation. I settled on that as a topic for worry, on grounds that while it was deeply concerning, it lacked the emotional aspects of some of the other things on my mental agenda. How full was the moon? I tried to recall what it had looked like the night before from the deck of the Teal. I hadn't really noticed, so it wasn't near the full. The full moon rising out of the sea is breathtaking, with that shining path across the water that makes you feel how simple it would be to step over the rail and walk straight on into that peaceful radiance. No, no peaceful radiance last night. I'd gone up to the ship's head, though, quite late, instead of using a chamber pot, because I'd wanted air. It had been dark on deck, and I'd paused for a moment by the rail, because there was phosphorescence in the long, rolling waves, a beautiful, eerie glimmer of green light under the water, and the wake of the ship ploughed a glowing furrow through the sea. Dark moon, then, I decided, or a sliver, which would amount to the same thing. We couldn't come close into shore by night, then. I didn't know how far north we were. Maybe John Smith did, but was aware that the coastline of the Chesapeake involved all kinds of channels, sandbars, tide flats, and ship traffic. Wait, though. Smith had said we'd passed Norfolk. Well, bloody hell, I said, exasperated. Where is Norfolk? I knew where it was in relation to Highway I-64. But had no notion whatever what the blasted place looked like from the ocean. And if we were obliged to stand far out from land during the night, what was to keep us from drifting very far out to sea? Well, on the good side, we needn't trouble about running out of gas, I said encouragingly to myself. Food and water? Well, not yet, at least. I seem to be running out of good impersonal worrying material. What about Jamie's seasickness, or any other medical catastrophe that might occur aboard? Yes, that was a good one. I had no herbs, no needles, no sutures, no bandages, no instrument. I was, for the moment, completely without any practical medicine at all, save boiling water, and what skill might be contained in my two hands. I suppose I could reduce a dislocation or put my thumbs on a spurting artery, I said aloud, but that's about it. Ah, said a deeply uncertain voice behind me, and I spun round, inadvertently spattering stew from my ladle. Oh, Mr. Smith. Didn't mean to take you unawares, ma'am. He sidled into the light like a wary spider, keeping a cautious distance from me. Especially not as I saw your nephew hand you back that knife of yours. He smiled a little to indicate that this was a joke, but he was plainly uneasy. You were right handy with it, I must say. Yes, I said flatly, picking up a rag to mop the splatters. I've had practice. This led to a marked silence. After a moment or two, he coughed. Mr. Fraser sent me to ask, in a gingerly sort of way, whether there might be anything to eat soon. I gave a grudging snort of laughter at that. Was that gingerly his idea or yours? His, he replied promptly. You can tell him the food is ready whenever anyone likes to come and eat it. Oh, Mr. Smith? He turned back at once, earrings swinging. I only wondered, what do the men, well, they must be very upset, of course, but what do the hands from the Teal feel about recent developments? If you happen to know, that is, I added.
I know. Mr. Fraser asked me that not 10 minutes ago, he said, looking mildly amused. We've been a-talking up in the tops, as you may imagine, ma'am.
Oh, I do.
Well, we're much relieved not to be pressed, of course. Was that to happen, likely none of us would see home nor family again for years, to say nothing of being forced maybe to fight our own countrymen.
He scratched at his chin. Like all the men, he was becoming bristly and piratical-looking.
On t'other hand, though, Well, you must allow of our situation at the moment be not all our friends might wish. Perilous, I mean to say. And us now minus our pay and our clothes to boot.
Yes, I can see that. From your point of view, what might be the most desirable outcome of our situation?
Make land as near to New Haven as we can get, but not in the harbour. Run her aground on a gravel bar and set her afire, he replied promptly. Take her boat ashore, then run like the dickens.
Would you burn the ship with the sailors in the hold? I asked, as a matter of curiosity. To my relief, he appeared shocked at the suggestion.
Oh, no, ma'am. Might be as Mr. Fraser would want to turn them over to the Continentals to use for exchange, maybe. But we wouldn't mind was they to be set free, either.
That's very magnanimous of you, I assured him gravely, and I'm sure Mr. Fraser is very grateful for your recommendations. Do you,
know where the Continental Army is just now? Somewhere in New Jersey is what I heard, he replied with a brief smile. I don't suppose they'd be that hard to find, though, if you wanted them.
Aside from the Royal Navy, the last thing I personally wanted to see was the Continental Army, even at a distance. New Jersey seemed safely remote, though. I sent him to rummage the crew's quarters for utensils. Each man would have his own mess kit and spoon, and set about the tricky task of lighting the two lamps that hung over the mess table, in hopes that we might see what we were eating. Having got a closer look at the stew, I changed my mind about the desirability of more illumination, but considering how much trouble it had been to light the lamps, wasn't disposed to blow them out either. All in all, the meal wasn't bad, though it likely wouldn't have mattered if I'd fed them raw grits and fish heads. The men were famished. They devoured the food like a horde of cheerful locusts, their spirits remarkably high, considering our situation. Not for the first time, I marvelled at the ability of men to function capably in the midst of uncertainty and danger. Part of it, of course, was Jamie. One couldn't overlook the irony of someone who hated the sea and ships as he did, suddenly becoming the de facto captain of a naval cutter. But while he might loathe ships, he did, in fact, know more or less how one was run, and he had the knack of calm in the face of chaos, as well as a natural sense of command.
If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, I thought, watching him talk calmly and sensibly to the men.
Pure adrenaline had kept me going until now, but now, out of immediate danger, it was fading fast. Between fatigue, worry, and a bruised throat, I was able to eat only a bite or two of the stew. My other bruises had begun to throb, and my knee still felt tender. I was taking a morbid inventory of physical damage when I saw Jamie's eyes fixed on me.
You need food, Sassenach, he said mildly. Eat.
I opened my mouth to say that I wasn't hungry, but thought better of it. The last thing he needed was to worry about me.
Aye, aye, Captain, I said, and resignedly picked up my spoon.
Chapter 31. A Guided Tour Through the Chambers of the Heart. I should be going to sleep. God knew I needed sleep, and there would be precious little of it until we reached New Haven.
If we ever do,
the back of my mind commented sceptically, but I ignored this remark as unhelpful to the current situation. I longed to plunge into sleep, as much to escape the fears and uncertainties of my mind as to restore my much abused flesh. I was so tired, though, that mind and body had begun to separate. It was a familiar phenomenon. Doctors, soldiers, and mothers encounter it routinely. I had any number of times. Unable to respond to an immediate emergency while clouded by fatigue, the mind simply withdraws a little, separating itself fastidiously from the body's overwhelming self-centered needs. From this clinical distance, it can direct things, bypassing emotions, pain, and tiredness, making necessary decisions,
cold-bloodedly overruling the mindless body's needs for food, water, sleep, love, grief, pushing it past its fail-safe points. Why emotions? I wondered dimly. Surely emotion was a function of the mind, and yet it seemed so deeply rooted in the flesh that this abdication of the mind always suppressed emotion too. The body resents this abdication, I think. Ignored and abused, it will not easily let the mind return. Often the separation persists until one is finally allowed to sleep. With the body absorbed in its quiet intensities of regeneration, the mind settles cautiously back into the turbulent flesh, feeling its delicate way through the twisting passages of dreams, making peace. And you wake once more whole. But not yet. I had the feeling that something remained to be done, but no idea what. I had fed the men, sent food to the prisoners, checked the wounded, reloaded all the pistols, cleaned the stew pot. My slowing mind went blank. I set my hands on the table, fingertips feeling out the grain of the wood, as though the tiny ridges worn smooth by years of service might be the map that would enable me to find my way to sleep. I could see myself in the eye of the mind sitting there, slender, nearly scrawny. The edge of my radius showed sharp against the skin of my forearm. I'd got thinner than I realized over the last few weeks of travelling, round-shouldered with fatigue, hair, a bushy, tangled mass of writhing strands streaked with silver and white, a dozen shades of dark and light. It reminded me of something Jamie had told me, some expression the Cherokee had. Combing snakes from the hair, that was it. To relieve the mind of worry, anger, fear, possession by demons, that was to comb the snakes from your hair. Very apt. I did not, of course, possess a comb at the moment. I'd had one in my pocket, but had lost it in the struggle. My mind felt like a balloon tugging stubbornly at its tether. I wouldn't let it go, though. I was suddenly and irrationally afraid that it might not come back at all. Instead, I focused my attention fiercely on small physical details. The weight of the chicken stew and bread in my belly, the smell of the oil in the lamps, hot and fishy, the thump of feet on the deck above, and the song of the wind, the hiss of water down the sides of the ship. The feel of a blade in flesh. Not the power of purpose, the guided destruction of surgery, damage done in order to heal. A panicked stab, the jump and stutter of a blade striking bone unexpected, the wild careen of an uncontrolled knife, and the wide dark stain on the deck, fresh wet and smelling of iron. I didn't mean it, I whispered aloud. Oh, God, I didn't mean it. Quite without warning, I began to cry. No sobbing, no throat-gripping spasms. Water simply welled in my eyes and flowed down my cheeks, slow as cold honey. A quiet acknowledgement of despair as things spiraled slowly out of control.
What is it, lass?
Jamie's voice came softly from the door. I'm so tired, I said thickly. So tired. The bench creaked under his weight as he sat beside me, and a filthy handkerchief dabbed gently at my cheeks. He put an arm round me and whispered to me in Gaelic, the soothing endearments one makes to a startled animal. I turned my cheek into his shirt and closed my eyes. The tears were still running down my face, but I was beginning to feel better. Still weary unto death, but not utterly destroyed. I wish I hadn't killed that man, I whispered. His fingers had been smoothing the hair behind my ear. They paused for a moment, then resumed.
You didn't kill anyone, he said, sounding surprised. Was that what's been troubling you, Sassenach?
Among other things, yes. I sat up, wiping my nose on my sleeve, and stared at him. I didn't kill the gunner. Are you sure? His mouth drew up in what might have been a smile, if it were a shade less grim.
I'm sure. I killed him, Anian.
You?
Oh. I sniffed and looked at him closely.
You aren't saying that to make me feel better.
I am not.
The smile faded.
I wish I hadn't killed him either. Not much choice about it, though.
He reached out and pushed a lock of hair behind my ear with a forefinger.
Dinna fash yourself about it, Sassenach. I can stand it.
I was crying again, but this time with feeling. I wept with pain and with sorrow, certainly with fear. But the pain and sorrow were for Jamie and the man he had no choice but to kill, and that made all the difference. After a bit, the storm subsided, leaving me limp but whole. The buzzing sense of detachment had gone. Jamie had turned round on the bench, his back against the table as he held me on his lap, and we sat in peaceful silence for a bit, watching the glow of the fading coals in the galley fire and the wisps of steam rising from the cauldron of hot water.
I should put something on to cook through the night, I thought drowsily.
I glanced at the cages where the chickens had settled themselves to sleep, with no more than an occasional brief cluck of startlement as one roused from whatever chickens dream about. No, I couldn't bring myself to kill a hen tonight. The men would have to do with whatever came to hand in the morning. Jamie had also noticed the chickens, though to different effect.
Do you recall Mrs. Bug's chickens? He said with a rueful humour. Wee Jem and Roger Mack.
Oh, God, poor Mrs. Bug. Jem, aged 5 or so, had been entrusted with the daily chore of counting the hens to be sure they had all returned to their coop at night. After which, of course, the door was fastened securely to keep out foxes, badgers, or other chicken-loving predators. Only Jem had forgotten.
Just once.
But once was enough. A fox had got into the hen coop, and the carnage had been terrible. It's all rot to say that man is the only creature who kills for pleasure. Possibly they learned it from men, but all the dog family do it too. Foxes, wolves, and theoretically domesticated dogs as well. The walls of the hen coop had been plastered with blood and feathers.
Oh, my bairnies,
Mrs. Bug kept saying, tears rolling down her cheeks like beads.
Oh, my poor wee bairnies.
Jem, called into the kitchen, couldn't look.
I'm sorry, he whispered, eyes on the floor. I'm really sorry.
Well, and so you should be, Roger had said to him. But sorry's no going to help much, is it?
Jemmy shook his head, mute, and tears welled in his eyes. Roger cleared his throat with a noise of gruff menace.
Well, here it is then. If you're old enough to be trusted with a job, you're old enough to take the consequences of breaking that trust. Do you understand me?
It was rather obvious that he didn't, but he bobbed his head earnestly, sniffing. Roger took in a deep breath through his nose.
I mean, he said, I'm going to whip you.
Jem's small, round face went blank. He blinked and looked at his mother open-mouthed. Brianna made a small movement toward him, but Jamie's hand closed on her arm, stopping her. Without looking at Bree, Roger put a hand on Jem's shoulder and turned him firmly toward the door.
Right, mate. Out.
He pointed toward the door.
Up to the stable and wait for me.
Jemmy gulped audibly. He'd gone a sickly grey when Mrs. Bug brought in the first feathery corpse, and subsequent events had not improved his colour. I thought he might throw up, but he didn't. He'd stopped crying and didn't start again, but seemed to shrink into himself, shoulders hunching.
Go, said Roger.
And he went. As Jemmy trudged out, head hanging, he looked so exactly like a prisoner headed for execution that I wasn't sure whether to laugh or cry. I caught Brianna's eye and saw that she was struggling with a similar feeling. She looked distressed, but her mouth twitched at the corner, and she looked hastily away.
Roger heaved an explosive sigh and made to follow, squaring his shoulders.
Christ, he muttered.
Jamie had been standing silent in the corner, watching the exchange, though not without sympathy. He moved just slightly, and Roger glanced at him. He coughed.
I ken it's the first time, but I think ye'd best make it hard, he said softly. The poor wee lad feels terrible.
Brianna cut her eyes at him, surprised, but Roger nodded, the grim line of his mouth relaxing a little. He followed Jem out, unbuckling his belt as he left. The three of us stood awkwardly round the kitchen, not quite sure what to do next. Brianna drew herself up with a sigh rather like Roger's, shook herself like a dog, and reached for one of the dead chickens.
Can we eat them?
I prodded one of the hens experimentally. The flesh moved under the skin, limp and wobbly, but the skin hadn't yet begun to separate. I picked the rooster up and sniffed. There was a sharp tang of dried blood and the musty scent of dribbled feces, but no sweet smell of rot.
I think so, if they're thoroughly cooked. The feathers won't be much good, but we can stew some and boil the rest for broth and fricassee.
Jamie went to fetch onions, garlic, and carrots from the root cellar, while Mrs. Bug retired to lie down, and Brianna and I began the messy job of plucking and gutting the victims. We didn't say much, beyond brief murmured queries and answers about the job at hand. When Jamie came back, though, Bree looked up at him as he set the basket of vegetables on the table beside her.
It will help? She asked seriously. Really?
He'd nodded.
You feel badly when you've done something wrong and want to put it right, aye? But there's no means to put something like that right again.
He gestured toward the pile of dead chickens. Flies were beginning to gather, crawling over the soft feathers.
The best you can do is feel you've paid for it.
A faint shriek reached us through the window. Brianna had started instinctively at the sound, but then shook her head slightly and reached for a chicken, waving away the flies.
I remember, I now said softly. So does Jemmy, I'm sure.
Jamie made a small sound of amusement, then lapsed into silence. I could feel his heart beating against my back, slow and steady. We kept watch at two-hour intervals all night, making sure that either Jamie, Ian, or myself was awake. John Smith seemed solid, but there was always a possibility that someone from the Teal might take it into his head to liberate the sailors in the hold, thinking that might save them from being hanged as pirates later. I managed the midnight watch well enough, but rousing at dawn was a struggle. I fought my way up out of a deep well lined with soft black wool, an aching fatigue clinging to my bruised and creaking limbs. Jamie had promptly fallen into the blanket-lined hammock directly I was out of it, and despite the urgent reflexive desire to tip him out and climb back in myself, I smiled a little. Either he had complete trust in my ability to keep watch, or he was about to die from fatigue and seasickness. Or both, I reflected, picking up the sea officer's cloak he'd just discarded. That was one thing gained from the present situation. I'd left the horrid dead leper's cloak aboard the Teal. This one was a vast improvement, being made of new dark blue thick wool lined with scarlet silk, and still holding a good deal of Jamie's body heat. I pulled it close around me, stroked his head to see if he would smile in his sleep. He did, just a twitch of the mouth, and made my way to the galley, yawning. Another small benefit, a canister of good Darjeeling tea in the cupboard. I'd built up the fire under the cauldron of water when I came to bed. It was hot clear through now, and I dipped out a cup, using what was obviously the captain's private china, painted with violets. I carried this above, and after an official stroll round the decks, eyeing the two hands on duty, Mr. Smith had the helm, I stood by the rail to drink my fragrant booty, watching the dawn come up out of the sea. If one were in the mood to count blessings,
And oddly enough, I seemed to be. Here was another one. I had seen dawnings in warm seas that came like the bloom of some tremendous flower, a great slow unfurling of heat and light. This was a northern sunrise, like the slow opening of a bivalve shell, cold and delicate, the sky shimmering nacre over a soft grey sea. There was something intimate about it, I thought, as though it presaged a day of secrets. Just as I was getting well stuck into the poetic thoughts, they were interrupted by a shout of, "Sail ho!" from directly above me. Captain Stebbings's violet-painted china cup shattered on the deck, and I whirled to see the tip of a white triangle on the horizon behind us, growing larger by the second. The next few moments were filled with low comedy as I rushed into the captain's cabin so flustered and out of breath that I was unable to do more than gasp, "Oh, sail ho!" like a demented Santa Claus. Jamie, who could spring to instant wakefulness out of a deep sleep, did so. He also attempted to spring out of bed, forgetting in the stress of the moment that he was in a hammock. By the time he picked himself up, swearing from the floor, feet were thundering on the deck as the rest of the teal's hands sprang more adroitly from their own hammocks and ran to see what was up. "Is it the teal?" I asked John Smith, straining my eyes to see. "Can you tell?" "Yes," he said absently, squinting at the sail. "Or, no, rather. I can tell, and she isn't. She's got three masts." "I'll take your word for it." At this distance, the approaching ship looked like a wavering cloud scudding toward us over the water. I couldn't make out her hull at all yet. "We don't need to run from her, do we?" I asked Jamie, who had rooted out a spyglass from Stebbings's desk and was examining our pursuer with a deep frown. He lowered the glass at this, shaking his head.
"It does not matter whether we need to or not. We'd no stand a chance."
He passed the glass to Smith, who clapped it to his eye, muttering,
"Colours. She's got no colours flying."
Jamie's head jerked sharply up and around at that, and I realised abruptly that the Pitt was still flying the Union Jack.
"That's good, don't you think?" I asked. "They won't trouble a naval ship, surely."
Jamie and John Smith both looked exceedingly dubious at this piece of logic.
"If they come within hailing distance, they'll likely notice something's fishy, and it ain't a whale," Smith said.
He glanced sideways at Jamie.
"Still, would you maybe think of putting on the captain's coat? It might help, at a distance." "If they get close enough for it to matter, it will no matter anyway," Jamie said, looking grim.
Still, he disappeared, pausing briefly to retch over the rail, and returned moments later, looking splendid, if you stood well back and squinted, in Captain Stebbings' uniform. As Stebbings was perhaps a foot shorter than Jamie, and a good deal larger round the middle, the coat strained across the shoulders and flapped around the waist. Both sleeves and breeches showed a much greater expanse of shirt sleeves and stocking than was usual, and the breeches had been cinched up in folds with Jamie's sword belt in order not to fall off. He was now sporting the captain's sword, I saw, and a pair of loaded pistols, as well as his own dirk. Ian's brows went up at sight of his uncle thus attired, but Jamie glared at him, and Ian said nothing, though his expression lightened for the first time since we had met the Pitt.
"Not so bad," Mr. Smith said, encouraging. "Might's well try to brass it out, eh? Nothing to be lost, after all." "Mm-hmm."
"The boy stood on the burning deck whence all but he had fled," I said, causing Jamie to switch the glare to me.
Having seen Guinea Dick, I wasn't worried about Ian's passing muster as a hand in the Royal Navy, tattoos and all. The rest of the teal's hands were fairly unexceptionable. We might just get away with it. The oncoming ship was close enough now for me to see her figurehead, a black-haired female who seemed to be clutching a...
"Is that really a snake she's holding?" I asked dubiously.
Ian leaned forward, squinting over my shoulder.
"It's got fangs. So's the ship, lad."
John Smith nodded at the vessel, and at this point I saw that indeed it did.
The long snouts of two small brass guns protruded from the bow, and as the wind drove her towards us at a slight angle, I could also see that she had gun ports. They might or might not be real. Merchantmen sometimes painted their sides with false gun ports to discourage interference. The bow chasers were real, though. One of them fired, a puff of white smoke and a small ball that splashed into the water near us.
"Is that courteous?"
Jamie asked dubiously.
"Does he mean to signal us?"
"Evidently not." Both bow chasers spoke together, and a ball tore through one of the sails overhead, leaving a large hole with singed edges. We gaped at it.
"What does he think he's about, firing on a king's ship?"
Smith demanded indignantly.
"He thinks he's a bloody privateer, and he means to take us, is what?"
Jamie said, recovering from his shock and hastily disrobing.
"Strike the colours, for God's sake."
Smith glanced uneasily between Jamie and the oncoming ship. Men were visible at the railings. Armed men.
"They have cannons and muskets, Mr. Smith," Jamie said, throwing his coat overboard with a heave that sent it spiralling out onto the waves. "I'm no going to try to fight them for His Majesty's ship. Run down that flag."
Mr. Smith bolted and began rooting among the myriad lines for the one connected to the Union Jack. Another boom came from the bow chasers, though this time a lucky roll of the sea carried us into a trough, and both balls passed over us. The colours came rattling down to land in an ignominious heap on the deck. I had a moment's scandalised, reflexive impulse to rush over and pick them up, but stopped myself. "Now what?" I asked, an uneasy eye on the ship. It was near enough that I could make out the shapes of the gunners who were definitely reloading the brass bow chasers and re-aiming them. And the men at the railings behind them were indeed bristling with armament. I thought I made out swords and cutlasses as well as muskets and pistols. The gunners had paused. Someone was pointing over the railing, turning to call to someone behind him. Shading my eyes with my hand, I saw the captain's coat afloat on the rising swell. That appeared to have baffled the privateer. I saw a man hop up onto the bow and stare toward us. What now? I wondered. Privateers could be anything from professional captains sailing under a letter of marque from one government or another to out-and-out pirates. If the vessel on our tail was the former, chances were that we would fare all right as passengers. If the latter, they could easily cut our throats and drop us into the sea. The man in the bow shouted something to his men and hopped down. The ship had hauled her wind for a moment. Now the bow turned, and the sails filled with an audible thump of wind.
"She's going to ram us," Smith said, his tone one of blank disbelief.
I was sure he was right. The figurehead was close enough that I could see the snake grasped in the woman's hand, pressed against her bare breast. Such is the nature of shock that I was conscious of my mind idly considering whether the ship was more likely named Cleopatra or Asp, when it passed us in a foaming rush and the air shattered in a crash of searing metal. The world dissolved, and I was lying flat, my face pressed into ground that smelled of butchery, deafened and straining for my life to hear the scream of the next mortar round, the one that would strike us dead centre. Something heavy had fallen on me, and I struggled mindlessly to get out from under it, to get to my feet and run anywhere, anywhere, away, away. I gradually realised from the feel of my throat that I was making whimpering noises and that the surface under my flattened cheek was salt, sticky board, not blood-soaked mud. The weight on my back moved suddenly of its own volition as Jamie rolled off, rising to his knees.
"Jesus Christ!" he shouted in fury. "What's wrong with you?"
The only answer to this was a single boom, this coming evidently from a gun at the stern of the other ship, which had passed us. I stood up, trembling, but so far past simple fright that I noticed with a purely detached sort of interest that there was a leg lying on the deck a few feet away. It was barefooted, clad in the torn-off leg of a pair of canvas breeches.
There was a good deal of blood spattered here and there.
Holy God! Holy God! Someone kept saying.
I glanced incuriously to the side and saw Mr. Smith staring upward with a look of horror. I looked too. The top of the single mast was gone, and the remains of sails and rigging sagged in a tattered, smoking mass over half the deck. Evidently, the privateer's gunports were not just for show. Dazed as I was, I hadn't even begun to ask myself why they'd done this. Jamie wasn't wasting any time asking questions either. He seized Mr. Smith by the arm.
Bloody hell! The wicked Nawid are coming back!
They were. The other ship had been moving too fast, I belatedly realized. She'd shot past as she unleashed her broadside, but likely only one of the heavy cannonballs had actually hit us, taking out the mast and the unfortunate Teal who'd been in the rigging. The rest of the Teals were now on deck, shouting questions. The only answer was dealt by the privateer, who was now describing a wide circle, only too clearly meaning to come back and finish what she'd started. I saw Ian glance sharply at the Pitt's cannon, but that was plainly futile. Even if the Teal's men included some with gunnery experience, there was no possibility of them being able to man the guns on the spur of the moment. The privateer had completed her circle. She was coming back. All over the Pitt's deck, men were shouting, waving their arms, crashing into one another as they stumbled toward the rail.
"We surrender, you filthy buggers," one of them screamed. "Are you deaf?"
Evidently so. A stray waft of wind brought me the sulphurous smell of slow match, and I could see muskets being brought to bear on us. A few of the men near me lost their heads and rushed below decks. I found myself thinking that perhaps that wasn't such a bad idea. Jamie had been waving and shouting beside me. Suddenly he was gone, though, and I turned to see him running across the deck. He whipped his shirt off over his head and leapt up onto our bow chaser, a gleaming brass gun called a Long Nine.